Composer David Newman is part of the most Oscar-nominated extended family of all time. You probably know his cousin Randy Newman, or the work of his brother Thomas and father Alfred. And you certainly know many of the 100-plus films David has scored, including the 1997 animated classic Anastasia, for which he received his Academy Award nomination. New Jersey Symphony Orchestra will play the score to one of my favorite of David's films, the 1996 adaptation of Roald Dahl's Matilda, live alongside a screening of the movie at the State Theater on Friday, March 22nd. David will be there to conduct the orchestra, and New Jersey's own Danny DeVito, who directed, co-produced, acted in, and narrated the film, will perform his narrator role live too. Matilda, which also features terrific performances by Mara Wilson and Rhea Perlman, tells the story of a super smart little girl with superpowers who fights evil and finds joy in outlandishly terrible circumstances. I talked with David Newman about the process of scoring films like this one, his legendary family, and his work preserving film music for future generations. Take a listen. David, thank you so much for your time today. It's so nice to meet you. You've scored so many of my favorite films.
Oh, it's lovely to hear. Thank you. Appreciate it.
So you're going to be conducting the score to the film Matilda, played by New Jersey Symphony Orchestra. What does that mean for people who have never seen a film score performed live?
You sit down, the film starts, and the music is muted. So we play the music live, but the soundtrack's from the film. So it is watching the film. It's just the orchestra part is playing live. That's what it is.
And Danny DeVito is going to be narrating this live as well, right?
Yeah, because this is an unusual thing. Generally, in a movie, you wouldn't do that. But Danny narrated, Danny directed the movie. And there's narration all through the movie.
Sure.
So we thought it would be a fun thing to have him along for the ride and do the narration live. So like we took the narration track from the film, from the dub, what we call the dub or the mix of the film, and we have that as a separate track. So it can be muted if he's there. If he's not there, it's unmuted and you hear it as it is in the film.
I mean, it's very cool because it is such a storybook element. And I feel like it almost is like Danny DeVito is reading you a story live orchestra.
Yeah. He'll come out and sit in an armchair and start telling the story of this little girl that's... She's like a knight errant. It's almost like she's Don Quixote for this woman that she meets that's kind to her, and she sort of fixes her life. It's a beautiful little story, a little parable, like a lot of Roald Dahl's stuff. It's got a lot of dark stuff in it, but it's a beautiful little metaphoric story about something that's kind of lovely. That she's saving this person that she loves, and everybody else in her life is so awful.
And Danny DeVito does just such an incredible job of being such a terrible person in this movie. He's fabulous in it.
Well, everybody in the movie is terrible except for Miss Honey and Matilda and her friends. But she defeats them. I mean, she's a fearless little knight. That's why it's so much fun to do a movie like that with music, because you can do a little bit more because it's sort of a fairy tale. Mm. It's a... once upon a time, long ago, there was a little girl, that it has those sorts of elements. It can be a little more operatic in a way, and it doesn't distract from the film. So we're really happy to do it live.
I mean, I grew up watching this movie. I'm a huge fan of this movie. And I rewatched it in preparation for this conversation, and I was really attuned to the music in it. And I had seen Casablanca performed by New Jersey Symphony Orchestra years ago. Mm-hmm. Similar situation. They pull out the music.
Yeah. It's the same thing. Yeah.
And it was such a phenomenal experience, because I think if you're somebody like me who is not a professional like you, I don't always hone in on the music the way I did when I heard it live. And it really changed the film watching experience for me.
Yeah, that's the thing about movie music that's so hard to understand. It's so weird because talking films didn't start that long ago. Mm. It's 1930. It's right after the stock market crashes in America. And there are a lot of Jewish refugees that are in Hollywood that have been working on silent film. But there's this incredible technological disruption where you can now put sound on films. Mm. And it's hard for us to imagine what that would have been like, because before the Jazz Singer, which was like 1927, 1928, which is just, there's just a little bit of sound on it. By 1930, there's like sound, they're stories, and it's this whole new weird art form, you know? And then music becomes a part of it. And they have to decide, well, what is music doing in a movie? Is it like, okay, so some band's playing on the movie. Okay, so there's music, you know, and everything. But when it's this underscore thing, which is what we think of as, you know, music and movies, it's underscore. It starts commenting on what's going on. And then it starts doing things that visual elements and oral elements or, you know, dialogue can't do.
Right.
And then it tends to unify it. But the thing is, if you're studying film and you're studying music and film, unless you take it away, you just can't tell what it's doing.
I'm noticing that you're using the music to help transition between scenes or between time periods or to establish characters or locations. And so what I was wondering is, what is your process? Are you, like, take Matilda, are you sitting down and looking at a script and a storyboard and having a chat with Danny DeVito, or are you getting video files and going through and scoring it that way?
You know, John Williams is sort of the uber, you know, late 20th century film composer. Basically what he says is correct, is that it's all pointless looking at a script. Hmm. You know, there's pre-production, there's a script, there's production, they shoot the film, everything changes, right? Casting changes it, everything, location scouting changes everything. And then they get into, like what you're saying, editing, and that changes everything. Hmm. So ideally for music, you want a locked picture. Now, normally you're not going to get a locked picture, but you treat it as a locked picture.
And for anybody who doesn't know what that means, a locked picture, picture lock means that it is in its final form, just in terms of like right. The length and where the cuts are.
Right. So because unlike every other oral element in film, music exists, you know, in a serial manner through it. So if you edit something, if you take out a half a second, it screws up all the music. So you either have to conform the music or rewrite the music, you know, and so you can see ad nauseum how this might become a problem. If you're working while they're editing, and most of the time you are, you have to learn how to deal with this. If it's not locked, but you still need to write, you eventually, you need to decide that this scene is locked. You know, you do it in scenes, you do what's called spotting the film. Hmm. And I think spotting is an old term. And I think what it means is if you took the whole film and rolled it all out, you know, old analog film, you'd spot music goes from here to here, it stops, goes from here to here, it stops, goes from here to here, it stops. And then those scenes you would work on. And quite frankly, movies are so weird because you're collaborating. It's a collaborating with a non-organic human media. You are collaborating with directors and editors and all that, but really what you're doing is collaborating with a film. And as you probably know, the more you edit something, it starts to like tell you what to do.
Sure.
You try something, you think, oh, this should work. And then you say, ugh, that doesn't work. And then you do something else, and it might be something that you don't even realize. And then it works. And so really good filmmakers and directors, they start to follow the film, what the film is asking for. And the same thing with the music.
So you and Danny DeVito have worked together on how many films?
Maybe six.
Yeah, it seems like it was several.
Five, six, I think.
You're clearly frequent collaborators. Is there something about that relationship that is really great for you? I'm sure you know Danny DeVito, obviously, huge New Jersey person. We all adore him here. What is it about working with him that's been so great for you? And vice versa.
Yeah, I mean, he has a weird point of view. In Matilda, there's a lot of interesting point of view. He's very operatic. It's very big and dark and then grand. And, you know, the first one we did was Throw Mama from the Train. Then we did War of the Roses. You know, War of the Roses is a divorce to the death. Throw Mama from the Train's a take on, you know, Strangers on a Train. And then we did Hoffa, which was a anti-hero movie well before there were, you know, anti-heroes. And then, you know, Matilda, which was his take on this Roald Dahl story. you know, a lot of the way where he puts the camera and kind of the colors and the it's very evocative for music.
You grew up in a musical family. Your father mm-hmm. was a film composer. Your cousin is Randy Newman. I think I read you are the most Oscar-nominated composer family of all time, something like that.
Well, my brother Tom has, I think, 13. Randy's won a couple and has a lot. I just have one. And my dad had like 54 nominations.
Wow.
So, yeah. The thing is, my father was born in 1900. And he was in Hollywood in 1930. So remember I was saying that that's when talking films really became commercially viable.
Sure.
So he was one of the pioneers. So Alfred Newman wrote the Fox logo. So that dun 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 dun, 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 dun. He wrote that,
oh my
gosh. Right in 1933 when he was at UA. He was at 20th Century Fox from 1939 to 1959. He died in 1970. So in my family, there were five kids. My younger brother, Thomas, is just 18 months younger. Him and I are doing film music. And my cousin Randy was Randy Newman. He's a big recording artist. Like I Love LA and Short People. And then my father's brother, Lionel, was head of Fox from like the middle 1960s to 1984.
Wow.
He was best friends with John Williams. John Williams went through the Fox system. I mean, it's a whole thing. And then there's a younger generation. Lionel's kid, Joey, is working now. Tom's kid, Julia Newman, just did a Feud. You know that?
FX, Truman Capote.
Yeah, it's about Truman Capote.
Oh, yes.
That show.
It's fabulous, yes.
So it's sort of a siren song in our family. Nobody went after it of our generation. You know, I wanted to be a conductor. Tom was doing Broadway and Randy was a recording artist, but we all just sort of gravitated towards it because it's so much fun when it works and it's not lonely. And it's, you know, because you're working with a whole bunch of people. And then there is a certain legacy about it that is alluring without being oppressive. Mm. My thing is, I'm like, as you can probably tell, I'm really interested in my father. I mean, like if you watch a 1931, 32, 33 movie, it's so weird. My father did a movie in 1931 called Street Scene, and the way it's scored, and then if you watch films in 32, 33, it's just so weird. And then by 1939, it's like Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind and Wuthering Heights, and you know, they like sort of technologically and artistically or figured out how to, you know, what that style was. So my dad was, you know, he's on a postage stamp, him and Max Steiner and Bernard Herrmann and all what they would call the pioneers. You know, I'm trying to find like letters and things that they wrote about, like they didn't know what to do, like how much music to put in it.
So interesting.
So they're all sort of trying to figure out, do I treat it like a play where you just have little incidental music, or is it just what we call, you just use diegetic music, which means you can only use music from something that is referenced by, you know, something that's happening on the film.
Sure, like a band playing or something.
Yeah, a band playing or whatever. And then you can use that, maybe use that artistically in some way to do it. Or what they sort of settled on was this kind of what they called commentative music, which really is a combination of Wagnerian sort of concept of what Wagner would call, well, he wouldn't have called it, but they called it leitmotifs, but basically themes for places, people, things, you know, whatever, and then referencing the same theme to make it into kind of a, you know, an abstract story. But they really didn't, it took him 4 or 5 years to sort of land on that, to have, you know, the directors and producers are really timid about doing that. They didn't really know what to do. And my dad, before that, in the 20s, was conducting Broadway shows. He didn't write any music until he was 30, until he came to Hollywood. It's a really interesting, weird history that hasn't really been, it's very American too, and it hasn't really been thought out yet. I mean, there is a lot of writing about it. There's a lot of scholarship about it, but it kind of it's not even 100 years old. So it's a little bit, in terms of the sort of Western art canon, it's still looked down upon a little bit. It's not really understood yet. And you can see the difficulty in getting extant material and studying it and seeing what it does.
You focused a lot of your career also on film music preservation. Tell me a little bit about that.
I have. From my early days, I've been interested in performing some of this music that I loved, and I found that it was very difficult to get it because the studios that owned the music weren't very good at preserving it or databasing it, or, you know, of course, at the time they couldn't even digitize it, but now they could digitize it all if they wanted, but it's all expensive and they don't want to do it. My wife and I, Chris, and I have been kind of on this for my whole career. I didn't start writing music till I was about 30, 29 or 30, just like my dad, actually. But, you know, I was doing a lot of conducting before, and we'd been trying to do this, you know, preserve this forever, because it's a mess, because the film studios own all the music. So they've all generally been one-offs. Nobody's ever wanted to perform it again once it's been recorded for the movie. So it's very hard to find the materials to perform it. And now that everyone does want to perform this music, it's a thing. It's difficult. You know, like MGM that did all those Busby Berkeley musicals and Wizard of Oz, they threw it all away in the 60s. They took all the music, all the sheet music.
Scores?
They threw everything. They needed the building for something else, and it was housing the music. Well, see, we can't even comprehend that now, but this is in the 60s. They put it in a dump under the 405 freeway in Los Angeles.
Literally?
Know? So, yeah, imagine what a piece of paper from Wizard of Oz would be worth just as ephemera.
Oh, my
just,
God.
Just an original page of score or a part from The Wizard of Oz, you know?
Oh, that's going to bother me for a long time. I can't believe that.
Yeah. Because they're not publishers. Even though they are de facto, when a film company does a movie and John Williams writes a Spielberg movie like E.T., Universal owns that music, not John Williams.
Right.
But Universal isn't a publisher.
Is it also historically important to hold on to these scores as well?
Yes, of course. It's profoundly historically important. And I think they're more realizing this now, but still that's not their business. They don't have any incentive to do it.
So how do you work on the film preservation piece of it? Like, what do you do?
Well, you go and you, it's a big treasure hunt. Let's say this. Okay. In 2011, we premiered the 1961 West Side Story movie with live orchestra at the Hollywood Bowl. Okay. Then we did it in New York. We did it in Chicago. We did, you know, I've done it 50 times, right? Okay. So when they were prepping that, they ask MGM, well, where's the music? You know, they don't have it. Nobody's got it. Nobody has the music. So you know where they found it? They found it in Robert Wise's estate, the director.
Huh.
So this is the thing, is you start to learn, it's like music, film music archaeology. Okay, it's not here, maybe it's here. And if it's not here, maybe the editor has a copy, or maybe the director has a copy, or the director's estate has a copy, or it was given as a gift to somebody, you know, that this person was really friendly with this composer. So maybe they have a copy. Do you understand what
yeah,
I'm saying?
Of course.
You start to learn the lay of the land and the history of who did what, where, when, and you just start looking for it. But it's not easy, and nobody can do it unless you know what you're doing.
Hmm.
No, you can't be in Cincinnati and say, I want to conduct, you know, something from, you know, All About Eve. You can't rent it. You wouldn't even know what to do, right? The shame of it is some high school student in Poughkeepsie, you know, wants to look at a score for blah, blah, blah. Forget it. You know, they can't look at it. And so that's what's so annoying to us.
And I assume that's important for training the next generation, too.
Yeah. And like I was talking about, like All About Eve, and I'll go and present it to a class of 20-year-olds. All About Eve has a very, very complicated exposition.
Mm-hmm.
It introduces five or six characters with a voiceover at the beginning. And all this stuff is going on in the music that you need to point it out. But you can't, you know, they can only see it when I show it to them. There's no way to like look at the music while the film is, you know, da 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 da. It's it's a problem of materials, and then all you can really do is kind of talk superficially about the film.
Is part of your interest helping preserve your dad's legacy as well?
Yeah, but my dad's legacy is pretty good. Fox, 20th Century Fox was pretty good about keeping their stuff together. Disney was very good. Walt Disney understood the legacy of what he was doing. 20th Century Fox, because of my father, actually was pretty good. But, you know, MGM and Paramount and, you know, Warner Brothers is okay. Again, it's just, you just have to know what you're doing or know somebody that knows what they're doing.
Are there any sort of holy grail scores that you just can't get your hands on that you think should be preserved?
I think at this point, even if we can't get our hands on it, we can do what's called a takedown. You can listen and write it down. There are people that can do that as well. So it's really just such a massive project and so time intensive. And there's not a huge incentive to do it because there's not a lot of money to be made. It's more, like you said, a historical kind of thing for, you know, that the Library of Congress would do. You know, the Academy in Los Angeles, they do have a library, but they do have film stuff there, but mostly it's scripts. And, you know, they've been great with, you know, Spielberg and Scorsese, and that they've been great with film, you know, restoring film and stuff. So film music's getting better, you know, but it's definitely a problem.
Do you think, in terms of getting that sort of artistic appreciation and recognition, that having orchestras like New Jersey Symphony Orchestra performing film scores live is a step towards that?
Yeah. First of all, you're convincing the musicians of the artistic nature of it. No, nobody's trying to write crappy music, you know. Film music is always looked on as crappy, you know, not very good, you know. I guarantee you, nobody writing this from the 30s on was trying to do that. They know everything that's going on. They know all the canonic repertoire. They're all really trained in everything. And like I said, it takes a few. Film music has a weird form. It doesn't have a concert music form. It's essentially functional music. It's functioning to be in conjunction with a narrative film thing. But it doesn't mean it cannot or is not artistic. But you have to like play it, like the whole thing. You have to play from the beginning to the end to figure out what are they doing. You can't just play like 2 minutes of it and say, well, that's the music from a film. You know, E.T. starts with a piccolo solo and a starfield as it comes down. So, you know, well, what does that mean?
Huh.
Well, maybe by the time you get to the end of the movie, you understand textural choices, orchestration choices, harmonic, you know, all these things that you can do with abstract music. Abstract music, just it means music without a text,
right.
You know. It's not abstract because it is functioning to be with a film. Until you get to the end of whatever the person is writing, you have no way of discussing what it is. So when you do these films all the way through, like you said, Casablanca, okay, you decide, okay, you do that, you rehearse it two or three times, you do two or three performances. Okay, now you can talk about it.
Hmm.
This has been going on now really since 2010, 11, like gangbusters for every orchestra everywhere. And they start to understand what it is. And then, you know, maybe somebody can write about it, talk about it, champion it. So we're just pleased as can be with the live movie, the film with live orchestra. Because then you can, it's not just excerpts. You can hear what they're doing.
David, thank you so much for your time today. This was fascinating, and I cannot wait to see Matilda live in concert. New Jersey Symphony Orchestra will present Matilda in concert on Friday, March 22nd at the State Theater. For more information, visit stnj.org. If you liked this episode, be sure to give us a review, subscribe, and tell your friends. A transcript of this podcast, as well as links to related content and more about the arts in New Jersey, can be found on jerseyarts.com. The Jersey Arts Podcast is presented by Art Pride New Jersey, advancing a state of creativity since 1986. The show is co-founded by and currently supported by funds from the New Jersey State Council on the Arts, with additional support from the National Endowment for the Arts. This episode was hosted, produced, and edited by yours truly, Maddie Orton. Executive producers are Jim Atkinson and Isaac Serna Diaz. Special thanks to David Newman. I'm Maddie Orton for the Jersey Arts Podcast. Thanks for listening.